Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. It's the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Much of our program this hour will be a wild ride through the very frustrating debate sometimes over genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. Our mission this hour is to inform you, but also to give you a sense of two of the biggest players in this debate. A chief scientist at the agribusiness giant Monsanto will be with us, and Vandana Shiva, environmental activist and crusader behind many of the GMO bans and labeling laws around the world, will also join us. Also, male gender bias in choosing animal subjects for medical research. The federal NIH has decided to end a practice that may have skewed results and dosages for popular approved treatments and drugs for decades. We'll talk about that this hour. But today is a day to remind ourselves that however much Barack Obama has wanted to focus on peace and the ending of war during his 6 trips to New York as president of the United States to speak to the UN General Assembly meeting, it just hasn't really been possible. This year is no exception. Fighting in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in Eastern Europe, global terrorism, all on the agenda, including the Ebola crisis. The president is also pushing his efforts to widen the global consensus to fight all of these battles. Cooperation to fight terrorism, for instance, is an effective and essential weapon for peace in the 21st century, he told the UN today.
Collectively, we must take concrete steps to address the danger posed by religiously motivated fanatics and the trends that fuel their recruitment. Moreover, this campaign against extremism goes beyond a narrow security challenge. For while we've degraded methodically core al-Qaeda and supported a transition to a sovereign Afghan government, extremist ideology has shifted to other places, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, where a quarter of young people have no job, where food and water could grow scarce, where corruption is rampant, and sectarian conflicts have become increasingly hard to contain.
The president is pushing for the UN to adopt a resolution that would allow sanctions to be applied to countries that don't join an international consensus to enact measures to restrict the travel of terrorist suspects and to keep them from crossing borders to join extremist organizations. Can such a new protocol for the 21st century work? Diallo Shamas is an attorney at the CLEAR, Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility Project, at the City University of New York. Diallo, welcome.
Thank you for having me, John.
So this smacks to me of something like the nonproliferation treaty, the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. If you don't sign it, you're subject to a bunch of sanctions. Now, that involves nuclear programs that are very specialized and rare. Can you do the same kind of thing, have a set of uniform rules for travel for terrorist suspects, and that if you don't follow them, you can sanction those countries?
It's really hard to imagine how this is going to work, particularly when the only track record we know of here in the United States of trying to prevent people to fly has been a formidable disaster.
The no-fly list.
The no-fly list.
How's that worked or not worked?
So the no-fly list is a government watch list, which currently has about 47,000 names. It's been a tenfold increase since the Obama administration.
And part of why it's a good model for this is because it's an example of shared consensus between security organizations in the United States. So CIA shares with FBI, FBI shares with local law enforcement, that sort of thing. Imagine if those were countries, they would share the information, you enact rules. That's sort of the idea here.
Well, that would be the ideal. It was an attempt to share information after 9/11, but it has ballooned into this monstrosity, which essentially prevents you from boarding any flight, but then doesn't really let you appeal or complain about or get any kind of meaningful review over your placement. So you can't contest whether or not you should be actually prevented from boarding.
So easy to get on the list, almost impossible to get off the list.
Basically impossible to get off the list. And there has been litigation ongoing for over 6 years now in different lawsuits. And a court has even said that this is the process that we provided is insufficient. And yet it's still there and it's still fully functioning.
So courts say there's no due process here and that has to be designed. If you were going to design the kind of due process that might work, what would it look like?
at the very minimum, you need to be able to challenge your placement in a meaningful way, right? So you should be able to, you need to be provided with the reasons for your placement, and that's not something that we provide now.
So you need to be notified in advance of travel. You can't just show up at the airport and expect to be able to challenge something.
Which is how it currently works.
Right.
And not only then, when you do show up at the airport and you're prevented from boarding, so now you know that you're on the no-fly list. The process to get yourself removed is just submitting a form that's this kind of online form that provides very little information, and the result that you get is a uniform letter, just neither confirming nor denying whether you're actually on the no-fly list.
No way to track the result of your challenge, of your protest, anything like that?
No way, and that's why this is the subject of so much litigation at the moment. So you can imagine how difficult it is to try to imagine this at the global level. How are we going to have a system of checks and balances? How are we going to provide the process if we can't implement it here with our fairly robust judicial system and we've been at it for so many years? How are we going to transfer that globally?
What are the complications you could envision with country-to-country agreements? You'd have maybe ethnic and religious requirements that might get in the way of U.S. civil liberties that would cause these sorts of restrictions? I mean, is that possible?
Exactly. I mean, it seems to be a Pandora's box of issues, right? I mean, if Syria were to provide us with a list of 100 names and asked us to prevent them from ever coming to the United States, we would want to know how they got that list of names, right? We would want to know whether it's based on testimony obtained through torture or whether it's just because it's from a minority group. And with the current system in place, and I haven't seen what Obama is proposing, it seems like that set of checks and balances is not going to be sufficient to preserve the liberties that we, you know, require.
Is there any international organization that you would trust or has any kind of a track record doing something like this, say the IAEA involved with nuclear transit, the International Air Travel Association, which deals with safety and uniform air travel rules?
You know, coordination is very important, and rather than it being necessarily the solution being through a particular organization, I think that lists and blacklists and requirements that don't have sufficient process is really what needs to be scrutinized. And unfortunately, it doesn't look like with the proposals that are on the table that they're going to be anything better than what we have here domestically. In fact, that would actually be a lot more than I would expect to see.
Can you give me the name of somebody who has been caught in the net, and you would expect to be caught in a net like this if it's enlarged to a global protocol of some kind, cases that maybe you have dealt with?
Unfortunately, all the cases that I have dealt with are people who have been caught in the net and who shouldn't have been caught in the net, and that's precisely the problem. When these kinds of lists and these kinds of regulations are a bit of a one-way ratchet, it's really easy to get on. It's very difficult to get off, and nobody wants anything to happen on their watch. And so law enforcement agencies and officers who are charged with, you know, keeping us all safe are going to err on the side of overplacement, right?
But we've established that. Are we talking about well-meaning sheikhs who work in mosques and cities? Or are we talking about business people, people with just names that are suspect?
We're talking about people who have family in the Middle East or who have family in Pakistan and who regularly travel over there, who are maybe from a region that is a region that's, you know, that has a certain degree of conflict, and who find themselves on this watch list because they fit that profile. They tend to be Muslim men, but it really is as broad as that sometimes.
Diallo Shamas is an attorney at the CLEAR, Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility Project at the City University of New York, questioning whether it's even workable to create a global protocol for the restricting of terrorist suspects in air travel border to border around the world. Diallo, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's just not normal to exclude women in this day and age. If you arrived on an island and there were only men living there, you wouldn't have to be a medical doctor to wonder about the health of such a community. So why is there such a strong men-only bias in the selection of medical research subjects? A few years ago, researchers at UC Berkeley and Smith College discovered a missing variable in the great majority of medical research on animals to develop better medical practices and new medications. That missing variable was women. In neuroscience alone, researchers conduct male-only studies more than five times as often as studies with female subjects. Now the National Institutes of Health is changing the rules, something way overdue, according to Emily Jacobs, a neuroscientist at Harvard Medical School who studies sex differences and hormonal changes in the brain. Welcome, Emily.
It's great to be here.
The idea that guys-only research, I mean, I know that's an overstatement, would have distorted results in the development of medications, you know, from my perspective, seems like a real no-brainer here. And for a neuroscientist, explain how we got to this situation.
Sure. So, you know, it takes almost a history of science perspective to understand why this status quo of using, of relying exclusively on male animals came into place, and really why today we're only now beginning to address that problem. I think it has to do with the fact that women really haven't had a voice in basic science and in my field in neuroscience, which is, you know, quite new. It's been dominated by male researchers. And because of that, I think the issue of questioning what the sex of the lab animal that you use in your studies just wasn't ever at the forefront. So I don't think it was a bias that was sort of intentional. It was almost just the default, the status quo. And no one really questioned why that might be a problem until now.
I guess it's easier for me to understand why a neuroscientist in the sort of old boys club there at Harvard and, you know, anywhere else, MIT, would prefer a male squash partner, okay, at the athletic mm-hmm. club there on campus. But why you would consider it normal to only choose experimental animals, that just seems completely, like, wrong.
Yeah, it's complicated. I mean, I think the argument tends to be twofold. One, that it's easier to house male animals, it's cheaper. And this idea of women having this pesky thing called the estrous cycle or menstrual cycle in humans, and having to control for that variability makes the basic science research infinitely more difficult. That was the argument all along. But it turns out that's just not true. So Irv Zucker at UC Berkeley published a beautiful seminal paper, series of papers, and his most recent one addressed that fact explicitly. So he looked at variability between men and women at a whole number of different endpoints. So looking at the cellular level, molecular level, physiological level, and behavioral level, and just said, what's the variability like between the male and female mice? And it turned out that there was not a single endpoint in which the females were more variable. And in fact, there were several endpoints in which the men, the male animals, were more variable. So it really kind of debunked that whole theory. So there's really just no good excuse now for why we can't include males and females in basic preclinical research. I think that the time has come to change that status quo.
And again, being something of the boor here, the idea that menstrual variability would affect, you know, outward behavior or outward outcomes, you know, is an issue that we kind of dispensed with in the driver's license age when we decided that, in fact, women were just fine as drivers, you know, back in the 1940s. I guess, you know, if you're a grad student and you go to your professor and say, my experiment is going to be needlessly complex if I use species that have certain cycles in them, you'd probably get a lower grade as a result of that. But if you apply for a grant and say only male experimental subjects, it's perfectly fine?
It was until today, until the announcement by the NIH that there is going to be a fundamental shift in policies that now require the inclusion of both sexes in preclinical research. So when a researcher applies for a grant, they have to have an inclusion plan that includes both sexes. And if they don't, there has to be a justification. There's also new funding initiatives that are being rolled out that really help apply this sex and gender lens to already funded NIH research. So it's a supplemental grant so that they can basically, you know, help encourage researchers who are already doing really important science to include female groups so that they can test for potential sex differences that might have profound effects at the level of human health. And that's really the crux of this whole issue, is that, you know, an over-reliance on male animals in preclinical basic research has the potential of obscuring sex differences that could guide clinical studies in humans. And what's at stake is not just the overall health of women, but I would argue really the integrity of medical research as a whole, and the health of the economy, which we know is overburdened by the enormous cost of fighting disease. And if we're obscuring sex differences that might help us, you know, tailor our treatments better, then, you know, this issue just has profound effects at all levels of analysis.
I saw a presentation a few years ago which suggested that the time that you give chemotherapy medication can have a crucial effect on how it's absorbed and its efficacy. And that is an issue that was never studied until very, very recently. So this is just the kind of thing that will have scientific implications. Can you name one possible scientific implication that has been, a harm as a result of male-only experimental subjects?
Sure. I mean, the classic example given is with Ambien. So it's a medication that was prescribed in the same dose, in the same way for men and women. And it turned out that women were reporting, showing up at emergency rooms, in droves because they were over-medicated. And now that, the FDA has cut the recommended dose by half because of side effects that were just quite frankly obscured because of that initial animal and clinical testing relying on the male model.
So it's really a brave new world here as a result of this decision and the possibilities going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to note that there's a lot of ways in which men and women don't differ, and it's important to know the scope of that. But it's also critical to know how we do differ and to sort of take that into account when we're trying to study the health and disease of the entire population.
Emily Jacobs is a neuroscientist at the Harvard Medical School, studies sex differences and hormonal changes in the brain, talking about the decision on the part of the National Institutes of Health to change grant specifications to require gender inclusion. Thanks, Emily.
Thanks.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
It was quite a summer for three special Takeaway listeners who were sharing with us their experience of surviving breast cancer. Now that autumn's chill is in the air, we can look back to some important days for the three women who have learned to value every single day. September 2nd, Lisa Eccles checks in on a late summer day with some exciting news.
I look forward to Thursday, which will be a big day for me. It will be my birthday, September the 4th. Will be my birthday. I turn 47. I'm so excited to be approaching that day because it could have been totally different.
A summer marked in birthdays. Lisa's on September 4th, another birthday back in July.
I am so thankful to be able to see my daughter turn 25 today.
That was July 29th, the day of joy and reflection for Lisa.
My mother did not get a chance to see me at the age of 25. And I see my daughter here at the age of 25. It just feels so good to me to be here. Today I cry tears of joy because I'm living in a moment that my mother did not see. And I thank God that I'm still here.
2 days earlier, our friend young Crystal Miller checked in. July 27th, a day of hard work in a summer of hard choices.
I got up at 6, got on the prayer line, showered, dressed, went to radiation, went to see my medical oncologist to tell her about the lump, went to work. On my lunch break, went to the ultrasound, went back to work, came home, spoke to my doctor about my results. It's just, it's a lot for one person sometimes.
Crystal, at age 28, pushes on, but she knows enough to realize that out there, her community supports her. People being tested like her, getting results like her, good news and bad. Just take each day as it comes.
But I know there's always somebody going through worse than I am. So I keep pushing and I keep getting up every morning and doing it. I guess until the day that this is behind me.
It is Thursday, August 21st. Yesterday, Wednesday, August 20th, was my last chemo. Today was my last Neulasta shot. And tomorrow is my birthday. I will be 55 years young.
Our third friend, Anita Coleman, in late August. This is her second time around with cancer. She takes the days with maybe more seasoning and wisdom than Crystal and Lisa. Her future has become the present.
I always remember and treasure the valleys that I go through because it's such a dynamic view when I get to the mountaintop and I look back over where I've come and I look to the horizon and I see what I've accomplished.
August 21st was a day for Anita to reach back to so many of you who have shared their stories and been touched by Anita's positive good humor at our Under Her Skin Facebook group. Her message? Something positive, of course.
All of you who are starting the journey, in the middle of the journey, ending the journey, know that it is a journey. It will take you to different heights because when you pull through this journey, there is no battle that you will ever lose again.
Team Anita, Lisa, and Crystal, they've given us 6 months of their precious lives in our series, Under Her Skin, Living with Breast Cancer. For all of you who want to join the conversation, you can visit our Facebook group at facebook.com and type in Under Her Skin. You can also hear more from our friends and your friends by visiting our site dedicated to their stories at thetakeaway.org. For the rest of the program, we're going to drop you into a very passionate, sometimes frustrating debate over the future of agriculture. Should genetic modification technology be used to make crops live longer, to resist pests and drought, to yield more harvest? Supporters of GMOs, which include the Gates Foundation and some huge corporations, claim they are essential to developing the capacity to feed a planet that will soon have more than 9 billion people. But critics say genetic engineering is just another way to exploit and harm the people of the third world.
This, to me, is one of the biggest outrages of the false promise of genetic engineering, that at the end of the day, it's based on stealing the biological heritage of the third world and then selling it as an invention.
Physics-trained Dr. Vandana Shiva is one of the leaders of the anti-GMO movement. Passionate, charismatic, a loud voice on social media, she has taken the lead in movements that have banned certain genetically modified seeds in India and the European Union. Her fiercest target, Monsanto Corporation.
Every new technology has its detractors. And, you know, I always often talk about the examples, you know, in other fields. So we've seen some folks in the area of human health who don't believe in the science of vaccines.
Robert Fraley, Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Monsanto Corporation. We're going to hear from both Fraley and Vandana Shiva this hour. We'll start you off with the issue of GMO food labeling. That's one of the most controversial issues in the GMO debate and one that has been before the U.S. Congress. Here's Vandana Shiva.
American public is finally saying, we want to know what we eat. We need labeling laws. A simple democratic law of saying, I know what's in my food. Why is millions and millions of dollars being poured to kill labeling initiatives or sue states like Vermont? Why?
Monsanto says that the laws that exist now are perfectly adequate to determine which are GMO and which are GMO-free foods in the United States. What do you say to that?
Well, I trust the American public to know better about what's in the interest of the American public than Monsanto's judgment. After all, democracy means Monsanto doesn't decide, the people do.
Monsanto's Robert Fraley says his company's lobbying effort is all about achieving clarity for the consumer.
We are absolutely supportive of companies who want to do, you know, the GMO-free labeling. You know, here in the U.S., remember, you know, 90% of the corn and soybean crop are GMO. So it is the base, you know, crop technology in the U.S. For consumers who want a GMO-free product, you know, we certainly encourage, you know, the use of the organic label, which by definition is GMO-free. So, you know, one perspective is consumers already have an enormous amount of choice between whether they want a GMO-free product or not. And so a lot of the conversation around labeling tends to be driven by folks who want to create labelings that are more punitive or would be of concern to a consumer. And those are the ones where we've intervened as a company. But we support the right for organizations to, you know, label their products as GMO-free. We think that type of voluntary labeling is exactly the type of approach that should be used.
But don't you contribute to the controversy by spending tens of millions lobbying against transparency and labeling bills in Congress?
Well, we're not against transparency. That was the point I was trying to make. We support the voluntary labeling systems that are already out there. Those labeling bills, you know, I would characterize as being very poorly written. They will be very costly to implement. And in the end, labeling is a national priority. And we would certainly support, you know, the FDA looking at a broad-based labeling approach. But to do it state by state and interfere with the transportation, with the ability of farmers to produce their crops and market them at a state-by-state level, I think would create a nightmare situation.
Couldn't you preempt this whole thing, though, by labeling what are GMO products? Couldn't you say, if this is such a boon for humanity, made with superior GMO-produced agricultural products for your health and the health of all mankind, something like that?
The way the labeling systems work is we label every bag of seed we sell around the world, you know, as containing, you know, our biotech traits. So we do label all of our seed products. The challenge that you're addressing is how does the processed foods and how do the food products get labeled? You know, as a seed company, we have a role in that, but that is the ultimate decision of the food companies and the FDA.
In many ways, this debate over food and genetic technology is a battle of two very different personalities, a quiet and powerful corporation that has served farmers for generations, and a charismatic and passionate activist who rails against soulless corporations. You will hear from both. Robert Fraley, the chief technology officer and executive vice president of Monsanto, grew up on a farm. He's the first to admit that he is anything but charismatic and that Monsanto has allowed its critics to get the best of them in the public relations battle over GMOs. When we spoke to him, he proudly handed us Monsanto's latest global PR effort, an adorable, if possibly misguided, little packet containing a computer USB drive in the shape of an ear of corn. Some informative videos you might like to look at sometime, he said. Fraley says Monsanto is committed to feeding the world. His critics, he says, use junk science to scare people about GMOs. For instance, plants with a genetic resistance to pests because their genes contain what are called neonicotinoids, an insecticide, are they responsible, as critics say, for the die-off of honeybees and bumblebees?
I would say our science and the science of a lot of the scientific leaders that are studying this tend to point to a different culprit, which is the varroa mite. So if you can imagine it, if you were a bee, a varroa mite would be about the size of a football on a person. And the varroa mite is latching on to the bee and draining it of its vital fluids, but at the same time, it's injecting into the bee maybe up to a dozen different viruses, which then further weaken and kill the bee, and that's what causes the colony collapse disorder. And I think most scientists see that as the real culprit. And in fact, we acquired a company called Biologics,
right,
that is using a new technology based on a Nobel Prize winning discovery that we think can help improve bee health. And we're doing a lot of testing to see whether we can use that technology to eliminate very specifically the mites and the viruses. And I think there's some very intriguing leads there that I think get us really to the culprit behind colony collapse disorder.
I just want to get you to respond to something that Eric Chiavian, who's a doctor at the Harvard Medical School, former director of the Center for Health and the Global Environment, he published this in The New Yorker. A large body of scientific evidence points to neonicotinoids as the main reason behind the recent die-off of honeybees around the world. You've addressed that. As a result, the most widely used neonicotinoids have been banned in the European Union for at least the next year and a half. They're found in ground and surface waters and in the food we eat. They've been shown to disrupt nerve cell activities in mammals. I'm deeply concerned, this doctor writes, that neonicotinoids may harm humans as well. What do you say about that?
We don't sell those products, and I'm not privy to all of the information that you've talked about there. you know, I know these products have been approved, you know, previously in Europe and the U.S., and they have a, they've had a, an excellent safety record, and they've been, you know, thoroughly studied. I know the EU is re-reviewing the data and, you know, may reintroduce those products in another couple of years.
Do you understand how some people have a problem with thinking about seeds as intellectual property, patentable intellectual property? And so if you suddenly get a seed that might have been inadvertently fertilized by a GMO-produced plant, that you can be liable for actually using that seed if you're, you know, in Bangladesh or somewhere like that?
You know, I understand the concern. I understand how it's been used by activists, and I understand the lack of any data behind it that supports that there's ever been an issue. So let's just take, you know, one example here. I grew up on a small farm. When we were planting corn, the first thing we would do is, were we going to plant white corn or yellow corn? Were we going to plant sweet corn? Were we going to plant high amylose corn? The farmers would get together. You'd talk to your neighbor. If you were planting white corn across from a yellow corn, you'd talk about planting dates and pollination dates.
I have that problem in my own garden.
And so, and that's all worked out. And the strength of U.S. agriculture is the fact that we can, you know, even in a crop like corn that is, you know, composed of 20 different, you know, subcrops, you know, we can grow those crops and grow them successfully. The same thing has happened, you know, between, you know, conventional and GMO crops. And, you know, while there's stories that you can find on the internet, there's really been no, you know, practical implication relative to the impact of growing these crops side by side. And as a company, you know, I think the great strength of U.S. agriculture is its diversity and the fact that we can make conventional, organic, and GMO farming work side by side to give the market the flexibility it needs and consumers the products that they want.
We interviewed a scientist a while ago, just to give you an experience that we've had, talking very much about the bad science of GMO critics and the hysteria that they've created in terms of fears of agricultural products from Monsanto and other groups. And we got huge pushback among listeners saying, you bought a line, you've taken the propaganda. And so we asked today, I'm going to interview you, what should I ask you? This isn't scientific, but this is just a typical example of some of the questions that they ask. They're not even terribly responsible questions, but they represent an emotional cord here. Why are you strong-arming El Salvador over their using of local seeds? Do you frequently use the U.S. government to bully small countries? Why do you punish farmers when non-Monsanto soybeans land on their farm? Is he feeding the same stuff they're growing to his or her children? And they didn't use the word stuff there. What's your response to that sense out there?
Again, going back to the example on vaccines, the whole fear of vaccines, you know, was created by junk science. Here are the facts. There's 7.2 billion people on the planet today. All of the estimates say that by 2050, that will reach 9.5 billion people. We also know that we'll see another couple billion people join the middle class as world wealth increases across Asia and Africa. So between now and 2050, we need to double the food supply. It's probably the greatest challenge facing mankind. And instead of, you know, spending our time talking about, you know, the activists and the myths on the internet, we should be having the conversation about how do we use the technologies that we have today? How do we invent new ones? How do we talk about food conservation and waste reduction? And how do we really build a plan so that we can achieve, you know, food security by 2050?
Robert Fraley is the Chief Technology Officer and Executive Vice President of Monsanto Corporation. And now to the other side of this debate. Vandana Shiva is an author, environmental activist, and the charismatic founder of Navdanya, a movement of 500,000 seed keepers and organic farmers in India. She gives rousing speeches about corporate agribusiness destroying traditional farms, but she often also makes additional frightening claims that GMOs cause farmer suicides, malnutrition, and toxic contamination. Monsanto and its scientists have made billions, she says, while millions of people have suffered.
The technology of genetic engineering, which is what made Monsanto a seed giant, before that it was just a chemical giant, that genetic engineering technology is not a breeding technology. It takes existing plants that have been bred by farmers through selection or crossbreeding or hybrids, and then it introduces through shooting with a gene gun a gene that doesn't belong to that plant. And so far, the majority of applications have been two traits. One is called Bt toxin, where Bt is Bacillus thuringiensis, pulling a gene out of a soil organism to now produce a pesticide inside the plant. And the second family is herbicide-tolerant crops, where Roundup can be sprayed on plants, and the plant survives, but everything else dies. Now, not only have these not increased yields, they actually are leading to decline in yields where superpests and superweeds are now overtaking agriculture.
What do you make of the success on cotton production in India that is a result directly of genetically engineered seeds?
Unfortunately, that too is not true. The Cotton Research Institute of India, which is the premier institute, has done studies and has shown...
The World Trade Administration says that India is one of the biggest producers of cotton, and that was never the case even 10 years ago.
No, that's not true. India was the biggest producer of cotton. Through history, we domesticated cotton. We got freedom with Gandhi spinning cotton. During the 10 years pre-GMOs was 10 years where the U.S. was subsidizing cotton up to $4 billion a year. This was the subject of the collapse of the Cancun meetings of the World Trade Organizations, because the Africans said, you're killing us with the subsidy. And as long as the subsidies were in place, a lot of dumping was taking place, which meant countries like India couldn't export. When it's the subsidy factor and the trade factor that was changed, India could start exporting again.
So
we were exporting
success,
before. The success is actually the removal of the subsidy distortion.
It has nothing to do with the GMOs.
Nothing to do with the GMOs at all. And where we have increased cotton production is because we've increased acreage. And it's the same story with the Green Revolution. India produced more rice and wheat, but we increased acreage of rice and wheat. We've shown that the land and the irrigation explain the increase in production. The idea of miracle seeds and chemicals and now miracle GMOs is covering up the real roots of where production increases.
Lots of issues, lots of discussion. For instance, can GMOs help to control pests and reduce the use of chemical pesticides? Vandana Shiva had a lot to say about this. You can hear it in a longer version of this interview at thetakeaway.org. But I wanted to focus on one of the purported miracles of GMO technology, golden rice. You may have heard of it. It's a largely banned genetically engineered product that enriches rice with beta-carotene, the source of vitamin A, to address blindness, disease, and other problems caused by vitamin deficiencies.
Golden rice, my critique of golden rice is twofold. First, that it promotes the monocultures that are at the heart of the malnutrition problem, because if we grow diversity, you don't have deficiencies in minerals, trace elements, and micronutrients. Second, if you grow biodiversity and you compare the vitamin A production of the amaranth, the coriander that we use daily in our food, the curry leaves, they have much richer production of vitamin A. So just give every woman a kitchen garden and you've solved the vitamin A problem.
But that doesn't mean that golden rice wouldn't have some benefit.
No, it doesn't have benefit. If it's 100%, 300% less productive in vitamin A and your better alternatives are available, then you don't really need golden rice, particularly when the spread of golden rice within a chemical agriculture model is going to destroy the sources of vitamin A that people could have for free.
So golden rice would actually destroy agricultural production if it was allowed to be used.
Exactly. But I would add, the next miracle they're trying to come up with is a so-called GMO banana, promising to provide iron to women who have iron deficiency anemia in India and produce vitamin A for the Ugandans. For India, on iron, we've shown that 7,000% more iron we can have through biodiversity. We've also found that the GMO banana is biopirated, which means the yellowness has been taken through theft from Micronesia. This, to me, is one of the biggest outrages of the false promise of genetic engineering, that at the end of the day, it's based on stealing the biological heritage of the third world, their knowledge, and then selling it as an invention. If Monsanto takes soya bean, which is an East Asian crop, puts one toxic gene into it and says, I've invented the seed, that is not creation. It is not invention.
Why is Monsanto directly responsible and answerable for the suicides of Indian farmers?
You know, I have a very plain logic to this. If you say you own something, then you own the impacts of that something. You're selling a seed where you're collecting royalty in the name of technology fees and technology trade,
right,
because India doesn't allow patenting. And you're collecting that, and that is shooting up the price.
So the price pushes the farmers into insolvency. The insolvency causes the suicide.
Exactly.
Why do the stats show that farmers are no more likely to commit suicide in India these days than other professions?
No, that's not true. And again, we
actually,
need
to, that is
no, true. No. What you need to look at is the pockets. You look at where that process is taking place. If most of the suicides are in the cotton areas, then you look at the processes in the cotton belt. You don't shoot up to national averages.
Why can you double food production faster than companies like Monsanto using technological means to increase food production?
We can double food production because we work with biodiversity, we work with the soil, we work with the pollinators. The first issue about industrial agriculture, it is destroying the planet. The second issue is it's giving us nutritionally empty commodities with no micronutrients, no trace elements, and that's why we have so many new diseases, which also need to be looked at much more. The third aspect is the fact that industrial agriculture, which uses 10 times more input than it produces as food, and also uses 10 times more finances than it can earn for the farmer, it's a negative economy. Farmers trapped in this negative economy is the reason family farms has disappeared. It's the reason our small peasants are being pushed off the land. When there are systems of farming that can give meaningful, viable livelihoods that protect the livelihoods of farmers.
Very persuasive, but I fear that you're conflating the debate over industrial agriculture, which is a legitimate debate, with the debate over GMOs, which is a fundamentally different discussion.
It's not a different discussion, and I think it is time to not let it be treated as independent. GMOs are part of an industrial agriculture system.
Right.
GMOs don't exist in and of themselves.
No, I understand that. But mass-scale agriculture is different from genetically modified corn.
No, genetically modified corn requires a conversion to industrial agriculture, which is why we will solve these problems of fruitless debate when we realize the gene doesn't exist independent of the plant and a GMO doesn't exist independent of agriculture system.
Vandana Shiva is an environmental activist and the founder of Navdanya, a movement of seed keepers and organic farmers in India. You can find a longer version of both of these conversations, my interview with Robert Fraley of Monsanto and Vandana Shiva. Just go to our website at thetakeaway.org. We also have transcripts of those conversations, a helpful glossary of some key terms in the GMO debate, which is all about getting you involved in this debate. You have lots to say. We know that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us again at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.